My name's Greg, if we haven't met. Greg Hartman. I'm on the teaching team here at RBC. I also teach math at VMI. And many years ago, my wife Michelle and I used to work at this church camp. And we had a bunch of different people on staff. There was a staff position called crew boy. It was high school guys who would mow the lawn, chop firewood, take out the trash, clean pots and pans, and amongst other things, be gophers and handyman helpers. So the guys who knew how to fix things need an extra set of hands. The crew boys would come along and help them with those kinds of things. One year, we had a guy, I'm going to call him John because that wasn't his name, but he was the worst crew boy ever. He did not mean to do wrong, but he always did. Like, it just never worked out right with John. There was a time where my dad actually worked maintenance there for a long time, and he needed to fix something at the pool. And so he had John with him, and he says, I need an adjustable wrench. The pool is here. The shop is way over there. John, would you grab me an adjustable wrench? And he goes, yes. Do you know where they are? Yes. So John leaves and goes and gets an adjustable wrench. I was doing something, and I kind of came across my dad, and I was like, oh, what are you working on? And he's like, I'm fixing this, blah, 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 and John's getting me a wrench. I was like, oh, okay. And then my dad's like, it's been a while, actually. I think I could have been to the shop and back twice. And so then I'm looking out, and I was like, oh, I think I can see him. I can just see his head. He's walking kind of funny, but he's coming. And I was like, okay. And then he kind of rounds a corner. I said, John's pushing a wheelbarrow. And my dad just gets quiet, and he goes, I hope there's a wrench in there. Nope. He was the worst crew boy ever. He came back with a wheelbarrow, and I have no idea what disconnect there was between adjustable wrench, wheelbarrow. We're in this series on the minor prophets. Minor just meaning they're shorter, not necessarily less important. And if you go through all the different names we've done so far, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, we get Jonah, and then we get Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Malachi is at the end there. They're all good people, except for Jonah. I'm going to make the case that Jonah was the worst prophet ever. And the book of Jonah, though, isn't about how bad Jonah is, but rather it's about the graciousness of God, and that's going to bring us hope as we look at his story and see what's going on. So we're going to be in Jonah. We're going to read a lot of Jonah. Brian thought he was impressive last week reading the whole book. We're reading way more. All right, here we go. Jonah chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. So we're going to stop right away. Jonah appears three times in the Bible. In the book of 2 Kings, he makes a prophecy to one of the kings. So if you remember, Israel splits in two after one of the kings of the southern kingdom makes poor choices, and the top half like splits away. So 10 tribes in the northern kingdom, they call that Israel. And then there's two tribes in the southern kingdom, they call that Judah. And Jonah is serving the northern kingdom. He's serving Israel. And then at some point in time, in the north, in the eastern side, a group, and you don't have to remember this, the Aramites, took some land. And Jonah goes to the king Jeroboam, who was actually one of the worst kings ever, and says, God says, go take the land back. Oftentimes, kings got involved with wars that were not good wars to get involved with, and then things went poorly. And Jonah's saying, God actually wants you to do this. Jeroboam goes to war. He takes the land back. And it's one of the few things Jeroboam does right. So not everything that Jonah does is wrong. All right. So that's the first time. Then we see Jonah in his book. And then we're going to come back to it later on. But Jonah shows up in the New Testament, in the Gospels. Jesus talks about him a couple times. All right. So now here we go. Verse 2. Go to the great city of Nineveh. What kind of city was Nineveh? It was great. And preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. We don't know yet why Jonah's running. The simple answer is he doesn't want to go to Nineveh. But why not? We also don't know, like, why did he run? Why not just stay where he is? Tarshish shows up in extra biblical places, although we don't really know where it is. If you think about, like, the Mediterranean Sea, It could be as far away as Spain. It could be North Africa. There are some references, and I'm way out of my league in this part, but there are some references that kind of make it sound like maybe it's just like a generic word for the Mediterranean area. It doesn't really matter where it was. If I told you that God had called me to teach math in Denver, and the next thing that you know is I drove to Norfolk and got on a boat, you would just say, I don't think he's going to Denver, right? So he runs away. Have you ever been to like the playground, a park? All the kids are playing and some mom calls out, hey, Johnny, it's time to go. And Johnny looks up, looks at his mom and turns around and runs the other way. I'm sure your kids have never done that, but we've seen the other kids that do that. And I've often wondered, like, why do kids do that? Like, what's the thought process in their head? I've done a lot of reading about like early childhood development, and I came to realize that little kids are very, very stupid. Like, if I run from mom, is she going to leave me here? No. Is she just going to let me play longer? No. It doesn't make any sense. So why did Jonah run? I don't know. He might not have been thinking. He might have been trying to like outlast God, if you will. Like, if I get in a boat and sail far away, God would be like, all right, I'll just send somebody else. He's too far. I can't get to him. I don't know what Jonah's thinking, all right? So he runs. All right, verse 4. Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God, and they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down and fell into a deep sleep. He was literally under the weather, right? The captain went to him and said, how can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of us so that we will not perish. Then the sailors said to each other, come, let us cast lots to find out who is responsible for this calamity. They cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. Stereotypically, sailors are a superstitious bunch. I don't know that every time a storm came up, did these sailors like blame it on a God that's God's angry? We got to cast lots to find out whose fault it is. Or were they experienced enough to like, this storm's different. This storm's got an attitude, right? I don't know what's going on. We got to pray. This is not the case, but in my head, I had this vision, like, it'd be really funny if here's the ship and the storm was like right around it. And there's like open sea, open skies everywhere. And no matter where they went, it just kind of like, oh, come on. You're chasing us, right? But so they cast lots. It falls on Jonah. And then verse 8, they asked him, tell us, who is responsible for making all this trouble for us? What kind of work do you do? Where do you come from? What's your country? From what people are you? And he answered, I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and dry land. That's probably better than what they can say about their gods. This terrified them, and they said, what have you done? They knew he was running away from the Lord because he had already told them, like, what have you done? You're running from your God? You must be the worst prophet ever, right? The sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked him, what should we do to make the sea calm down for us? He replies, pick me up and throw me into the sea, and it will become calm. I know that it's my fault and that this great storm has come on you. Instead, the men did their best to row to land. They're looking at him like, okay, wait. You're saying the storm is because of you. That's right. And if you get out of the boat, the storm's going to go away. That's right. Well, then why don't you get out of the boat? I die either way. I'm staying here. Like, you are the worst prophet ever, right? The sailors know for sure that if they toss him overboard, he's dead. And superstitious as they might be, I'm making this part up, there's like a 10% chance the storm goes away. Like, they have no guarantee it's going to actually work. So they are actually kind of noble. Like, we're not going to just kill you haphazardly. We can't just do that. So they did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder. It has an attitude than before. And they cried out to the Lord, okay, God, please, don't let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man, for you, Lord, have done as you pleased. And they took Jonah, threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord. That's got to be something, right? And they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. Now the Lord provided a huge fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. 3 days is not that long of a period of time. It's a very long time to be inside a fish. I started thinking about this. I mean, we know the story of Jonah because it's in every children's Bible, all this kind of stuff. And if you're claustrophobic, now's a great time to tune out. Jonah's in the worst storm of his life. He gets thrown overboard. I don't know how they throw him overboard, but I have fallen out of a ship before. It was not graceful. I can't imagine he did it on his own terms. So the last thing he's going to do is he's going to suck in as much air as he can. He hits the water. Who knows if he can swim? I have no idea how many clothes he's got on. He probably can't swim all that well. He's fighting in this storm, and then along comes this ginormous fish and swallows him whole. A giant fish that God appointed and gave 3 instructions to: don't chew, just swallow, swim east. Okay. At what point in time, when you're inside the belly of a fish, do you stop holding your breath? Like, I would probably just hold it forever. Like, I can't be sure that I'm actually in air anymore. Everything's slimy, right? It's so dark. But he finally, breathe out. And it smells so bad. And it's so tight. I'm sure he screamed. I'm sure he punched and he kicked. He was probably trying to figure out which way is up, which way is out. Can I crawl my way back out? What does it take to make sure I don't go farther in? All these things are going through his head. If he ever slept, it's because he cried himself to sleep. It would be awful. He probably needed therapy for years after this. But because he's a prophet, he knows God's voice. And it doesn't explicitly say this, but at some point in time, it sounds like he figures out that he's not going to die. And so chapter 2 is a prayer that Jonah prays. Verse 1 says, "From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord, his God. He said, 'In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the deep in the realm of the dead, I called for help, and you listened to my cry.'" We're going to skip down to verse 7, just because. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you in your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them, but I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed I will make good. I will say, salvation comes from the Lord. And this is gross, but "And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah out onto dry land." All right. One thing that's missing from this prayer: "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have run." It's not there, not even in the verses that we skipped. It's kind of weird. It's not there. "Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time, 'Go to that great city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I give you.'" And Jonah's like, "Well, let me check my calendar. Nothing on it. Let me check the wind. Yeah, it's too windy to haul rocks. So I guess I might as well go to Nineveh. Sounds like a plan. Let's do it." So Jonah obeyed the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. Nineveh was a very large city. It took 3 days to go through it. Jonah began by going a day's journey into the city, so roughly halfway, proclaiming, 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown." It's not clear. If you like to read different people, you would get a different story. Some say that's the heart of his message, and of course he said more things than that. Other people will say Jonah still didn't want to be there, and he said the minimum required. Walked in 40 more days and you're going to be overthrown. Either way, verse 5, "The Ninevites believed God. A fast was proclaimed, and all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloth. When Jonah's warning reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his royal robes, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. And then he issues a proclamation to Nineveh, basically saying, we all need to do the same kind of thing. We're going to skip that proclamation. verse 10, when God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he relented and did not bring on them the destruction he had threatened. Happy ending, right? Nineveh is spared. But to Jonah, chapter 4, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. He prayed to the Lord. I knew it! Isn't that what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? This is what I was trying to stop by running away. I know you're gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, God, kill me. It's better to die than to live. The Lord replied, is it right for you to be angry? Then Jonah goes out to the east of the city, makes himself a little shelter, sits down, and sulks over the fact that there's no meteorites falling on top of Nineveh, crushing it all. And God sends a plant. A little miraculous thing happens here. A plant grows up, leafy, and it kind of covers them and gives them shade. And he's like, this at least is nice. And then the next day, God appoints another very small-minded creature, a worm, to come and eat the base of the plant so that it's dying and it withers up. And then Jonah gets mad again. Verse 9. But God said to Jonah, is it right for you to be angry about the plant? It is, he said. I'm so angry, I wish I were dead. And God says, you have been concerned about this plant, though you did not tend it or make it grow. Sprang up overnight, died overnight. And should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also many animals? Don't forget the animals. And that's the end. That's how Jonah ends, right there. And many animals. It feels like you're reading Pride and Prejudice. And you don't know it, but someone has cut out like the last 6 pages of the story. And you're getting to the part where Mr. Darcy and Emma or whoever her name was are figuring things out. And it just stops. That's the end. All right, let's close in prayer. All right. What do we make of all this? Here are some lessons I think we can pull out of it. Not necessarily all the lessons by any means, but here are some things that stood out to me through this story. The first one is God routinely uses imperfect people to do his will. Jonah did not want to go to Nineveh. It didn't matter. He did not want to see the Ninevites repent. It didn't matter. We all have imperfections. You're very much more aware of your imperfections than anybody else. Don't let that hinder you from doing what God has called you to do. Don't, first of all, think that God can't use you, so therefore you're not even listening. And then if you feel like God is calling you to do something, don't think it's that you can't because I have these shortcomings. Not all of my life is in the way it's supposed to be. God uses imperfect people all the time. A real quick side note. Within the Christian world, we have famous Christians. We have Christian leaders who are good authors, pastors, preachers, musicians. We often look up to them. And it's really, really sad when we find out some of them have been living a double life. They were so good in some areas and so awful in others. God uses imperfect people. Does that mean we need to overlook their sin? No. Remember back to Hosea and other places. Sin is awful. It is awful. Right? So people who have done awful things need to be held accountable. But the reason that we are still blessed is because God uses imperfect people to do his will. Another thing that we can think about is that God is the God who pursues. Just up here a few minutes ago, she was talking about how felt like Jesus is always chasing her. Jonah runs away, and God loves Jonah. Like, Jonah, if I let you run, that's not good for you. I'm going to chase you down with a fish, right? bring you back. The Ninevites, I didn't actually mention this before because I forgot. Nineveh is the capital of Assyria. Assyria is not a Jewish nation. These are not God's chosen people. But God still loves humans who bear his image. And they were awful people. They really were. And God chased them. And God will chase you. And I feel very, very often that God is chasing me. The God of the Old Testament sometimes gets that bad reputation for being angry and vengeful and wrathful. And we see over and over in the Old Testament and the New that God pursues. And that's so great. Another thing we can learn from this is just asking ourselves, like, wait, how do we know the story of Jonah? How do we know how grouchy he was when he was sitting outside the city, like, looking down? And we don't know for sure. I think I'm in good company by saying this. I think Jonah told people. Because I think at some point in time, Jonah got it. He figured out, you know what? I was a knucklehead. And I will tell people my story. And I don't care that the book that's going to bear my name makes me look terrible. I was. And that's fine. If that's what it takes for other people to learn, great. But he's going to tell other people. He's not going to make himself look good. We see a similar thing happen in the New Testament. Tradition holds that the Gospel of Mark, written by a guy named Mark, who had spent time with Jesus, but he also writes a lot of stuff about Peter, James, and John when they were alone with Jesus. How do you know? Tradition holds that Peter told Mark a lot of things. And if you read the Gospel, Peter doesn't really come across as all that great either. Why not? Because Peter told Mark all the dumb stuff he did. It didn't matter to Peter that, like, he wasn't trying to make himself look as good as possible. The takeaway is that we are not defined by our best nor our worst experiences. It's fun to call Jonah the worst prophet ever, but he wasn't. Actually, there were some really bad prophets. Definitely Jonah got it wrong for a while. But that's not the only thing to know about Jonah. I think he got it later on. We said that Jonah shows up basically three times in the Bible. So in 2 Kings, in Jonah, and then in the Gospels, Jesus talks about him a couple of different times. I'm going to kind of lump them all together. We're going to jump into Matthew, where one of those cases are. Matthew 12, 38. Some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. Show us a trick. Prove to us that you are who you say you are." I don't know if I can say this the right way, but sometimes Jesus' responses to people seem weird to me. Like, they were asking something about this, and he's answering something over here. And it finally dawned on me, maybe this is meaningful to you, I don't know. Jesus is always in charge. And if people ask in some sense the wrong question, he's going to stay in charge and he's going to answer the question that they really needed to be answering. And when people say jump, he's just going to say no. I don't, you want a sign? That's not what I'm doing. So he answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asked for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up at that judgment with this generation and condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, who was the worst prophet ever. And now something greater than Jonah is here." Something greater than Jonah. I think if you are like me, and have been around the church for a long time, or maybe just sort of know the story of Jesus, whether it's really taken hold of you or not, the idea of his death and resurrection sort of seems normal, common. It's easy for me to forget how outrageous some of the things Jesus said were. If you go in the Old Testament, you see that there were a few people who were raised from the dead. Elijah did it. Elisha did it. Another time, people touched a dead body to Elisha's bones and he was raised from the dead. It had happened before. But Jesus is saying, I am going to die and come back. That's crazy. That's really, really big. And Jesus is saying, you want a sign? I'm the sign. You're going to kill me, and I'm going to come back. How much more proof do you need than that? Jonah, the book of Jonah, ends abruptly. It feels incomplete. And in some sense, I think it needs to be incomplete. Because this is Jonah's big problem. He did not like the Assyrians. They were bad people. He wanted to see God's judgment come down on them. And he did not know how to reconcile God's judgment that they deserved and God's grace that they don't deserve. We all know people we don't like. And most of us would not be in the camp to say, I dislike you so much, I don't want to see you become a Christian. Although, it's possible that some of you are in a place right now where you say, so-and-so has hurt me so much, I really want to see you rot in hell. And if that's the case, I'm sorry. But most of us, I know people that I don't like who desperately need Jesus. And I pray that they will come to know him. But if you also dug down deep in my heart, I would want them to become a Christian 5 minutes after I got to hit them really hard with a stick. Because Jesus' forgiveness is too easy. It's too free. They've done wrong and they're not paying enough. And I will bridge that gap. This is their sin, and this is what Jesus can forgive, and I'm going to beat the crap out of the rest of it, right? Jonah lives on the other side of the cross. It's hard before Jesus to reconcile judgment and grace. But that's what Jesus does. He came and he lived that perfect life. He was the perfect prophet who was called and didn't run, who sees people repent and he rejoices. He reunites judgment and grace for us. And in him, we can look at things in a completely new light. Yes, God uses imperfect people. But when God looks on us, he sees the righteousness of Christ. That's big. God is the God who pursues. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We're not defined by how good we do, how poor we are. It's for grace, by grace you've been saved through faith, not by the things that you do. We're going to wrap up here. The worship band, you guys can come on up and lead us with a song. The prayer team, if you guys want to be in the back corner to be with folks, if they want to come back, if you want to pray with someone for whatever reason, you can head over that way now or as we sing. The story of Jonah really is not the story of Jonah. It's the story of God's grace to us. It ends incomplete because we don't have the cross, but once we have the cross, we understand the bigger picture of what's going on behind the scenes. Jesus does unite for us that judgment and grace. I hope this morning fills you with some sort of hope that God can use you, and God will pursue you. God knows the good you've done and the bad you've done, and that's not what your salvation is based on. But rather, it's all based on what Jesus has done for us on the cross. We're going to sing that third song we sung this morning just because I liked it a lot. I asked that they would sing it again. There is no one like our God. If it was up to me, our judgment would be so much different. The story of Christ's redemption for us is not a story that I could have made up. And I'm so grateful for that. Whenever you guys are ready.